Should I attend that barbecue at my friend's house? What about a picnic in a park or an outdoor concert? These are all questions we're asking ourselves right now. And while some experts are calling for new quarantine measures, the reality we are living in is one of decisions, many times based on our gut or instincts. Researchers, however, at Georgia Tech have now created a tool that can actually help us make more rational, data-based decisions based on where we live. And we're joined now by one of the creators of the map, Joshua Weitz, a professor of biological sciences at Georgia Tech. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I have the map open right now, and I see
Sure. The
United States is mostly red and orange to signify the high risk level. And in Los Angeles County, where I am, it says that I have a 96% risk level, and that's for a gathering of 100 people. Can you break that down for me? How do I make sense of this as I weigh my decisions? What does 96% risk mean?
Right. So what we're trying to do is estimate the probability or chance that one or more individuals in a gathering of a certain size may have COVID-19. And we can get in and unpack how we get to that conclusion. There are certain assumptions we make. But in essence, what we're doing is taking recent reported cases from state and county health departments throughout the United States, which are then aggregated by the New York Times at the county level. And again, we're looking at recent cases, those that happened mm-hmm. the last 10 to 14 days approximately, as a proxy for the potential that individuals may be out and about circulating and given asymptomatic fractions may be unaware that they're sick. Mm. But we have to have some assumptions. So you've probably noticed there's a little button that says ascertainment bias. How many
yes.
cases are being reported for versus how many are really out there? So for every case that's reported, there may be 5 or even 10-fold as many actual cases. But we're taking those recent cases with this ascertainment bias and then doing the math, and we can get into that too, of how we go from that to this probability that if you were in a gathering of 100 folks, that one or more might be infected.
But then when I'm looking at this 96% risk level for where I am for a gathering of 100 people, I mean, even if that goes down a few numbers or up to 100, the risk is still very high.
The reality is that we're at a period of time, if you look at this map, that there are places in the country with high community transmission levels. And those high community transmission levels mean that when you are in a larger group, that there's a significantly elevated chance. And you're right, whether we're off a little bit on the ascertainment bias or not, these levels are significant, right? And my hope would be that then this lets people understand the need to wear a mask, reconsider whether they should be in an indoor setting for that long, reconsider the format of an event that they may be planning, or find some other way to interact. So it's crucial to understand that this is not the chance that you're going to get COVID-19. In fact, we're trying to communicate the risks associated with being in large gatherings precisely to help people reduce their risk of contracting the disease.
Joshua Weitz is a professor of biological sciences at Georgia Tech and one of the creators of a risk assessment map that shows you how likely you are to be around someone with COVID-19. We'll link that to you at hereandnow.org. Well, tools like his can help you evaluate risk and make decisions, but our next guest says all of this isn't so simple. Joining us now is David Ropeek. He's the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. And he says every time we make a calculation about risk, we're relying on our feelings as much as facts.
To really understand how we do this, though, it's worth stepping back a minute and working from the definition of the word risk itself, which most dictionaries say is something like the chance of something bad happening. So chance is the statistics, like the tools that you've been talking about. But that's only half the definition. The other part is bad, and how bad something feels to you is inescapably subjective. So no matter how much information we have from wonderful tools, we're still going to apply to them our life circumstances, you know, our health and wealth and circumstances and so forth, and our feelings more than the facts are what's going to drive our choices.
Right. It's subjective. You know, we talk a lot about whether
yeah.
states should declare stay-at-home orders. But way back in March, we saw a lot of people stopped moving around way before states gave them stay-at-home orders. How much do rules and regulations really influence our behavior here?
So rules and regulations are one input. So to somebody who follows the rules, they're going to lead to one choice. To somebody who doesn't like rules imposed on them, they're going to lead to a different choice. That's a feeling about how it feels to have rules imposed on you. That's a perfect example. And another one, Tonya, is that in March, we were all freaked out and staying home, and now we're going out and about. What's changed is the risk isn't as new as it was. When a risk is new, it's scarier because we don't understand it as well. And also, we like to have control over our lives, being able to go about our business, getting our hair cut and our tattoos and going to NASCAR races. And now we want that back. So that's competing against the fear of the disease. And you can see, I could go on, but this is all about our feelings, not just what the risk tools tell us.
Our feelings, but then also culturally as Americans. I mean, we see in other parts of the world, people are able to bring down the numbers of COVID-19 cases because they are following rules and regulations. We as Americans kind of have this independence that might be hindering us during all of this.
Yeah. So remember I said at the beginning that how we feel about any risk, COVID or whatever, is a matter of our life circumstances. So in any culture, that culture is going to have a voice. But it's an important point you raise. So the people who aren't wearing masks, they're getting a lot of attention in the media. But if you look past the headlines, most people do wear the masks. And that's because we all share around the world something called social altruism, which means that I will sacrifice some of my liberty, freedom, resources, whatever you want, in the name of the greater common good, so that the world works that way, so that other people are doing the same thing to protect me. When we're all afraid of the same thing at the same time, like this, we come together and do sacrifice, and most people are.
David, how big of a hurdle is it to the human brain that COVID-19 is pretty invisible? I mean, of course, we don't see the transmit, but most of us also don't see what's going on in these hospitals that have been overwhelmed. Is there something here about it being out of sight, out of mind for us?
Well, yeah, there is to some degree. But what's happening now in America as the virus finds more and more and more naive DNA to infect, more and more and more people are, in fact, encountering people they know who are sick or who have died. So when a risk is personified, when the risk has a face and a name, especially one you know, it does have much more power than when it's anonymous. And the higher our awareness is, the brighter the blip is on our fear radar screen. And I would say COVID's got a pretty bright blip going right now.
Yeah. I want to run a couple of scenarios by you. So many people, especially young people, are running into situations where they'll go to visit their parents, but they'll try to stay socially distant. And their parents will say, come on in. It's all right. Just come in the house. You know, it's like they assume that their kid is less likely to be contagious than a stranger. I know that goes back to what you were saying about feelings, but we know that that's not necessarily the case. Like, we sometimes think about the people we know as like, well, they are less at risk potentially for having COVID-19.
So the word here is trust. Family, friends, whoever it is that you trust, you will be less afraid of. That, by the way, also pertains to who's doing the communicating about COVID. So if the person telling you to wear the mask is someone you trust, or the person who's telling you, hey, you don't really have to wear the mask, go shopping, is telling you that, if you trust them, that information will have more influence. There have been outstanding examples of trustworthy risk communication and outstanding examples of poor risk communication. And the one defining factor in all of them is, does the person sound like they're really on my side?
Another scenario to run by you. So what about obsessive cleaning? This is something that we talk about so much on our show. We talk about schools and businesses and people bragging about how much they clean their surfaces, but the virus primarily spreads through the air. So what's up with that? Is this kind of like our desire to do something?
Yes, and you've hit on a brilliant core issue throughout any risk, but this one in particular. We feel less safe, the less control we have. Let me use a metaphor. Imagine you're driving a car. Now close your eyes, but keep driving. That's a lack of control. So now transfer this to a disease you can't see and you don't understand, and where all the scientists are saying they don't understand it. That is a feeling of, I don't know what I need to know to protect myself. That's powerlessness. And we'll do all sorts of things, like obsessive cleaning, like buying toilet paper, like buying guns, to give ourselves a sense of control, which gives us a sense of greater safety. And when we don't have it, we reach out for any way to get it, that sense of control.
David Ropeek, author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tanya. Be well.